Hello and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is a horny disco dancer. He's allegedly married, but from what I can tell, he's not being faithful.
Did you just call me a horny disco dancer?
Yes. How else would you describe him?
It's just usually you make up a story about me, but hey, it's me, Joel. It has nothing to do with the movie. I'm just a horny disco dancer. How's it going?
Yeah. So this episode is the first of the 1999 pairing. This is Summer Sam, the Spike Lee serial killer drama, epic thing. It's a lot of things. Every Spike movie, it's a lot of things. So to discuss this serial killer, I guess it's a horror movie too, kind of.
I mean, it's for being a movie that takes place during a real life serial killer on the loose. It's not really about that serial killer very much.
Yeah, I don't know. It kind of veers into horror a little bit, but I don't know. Anyway, that voice is High and Low All Star Gina. I think she had the most appearances.
Have I? All right.
4 or 5.
I'm just greedy that way. I demand to be on all podcasts.
Yeah. And welcome back.
Thank you.
And the other guest is Ben Sunday from the what was your episode again, Ben? Of the High and Low?
Ran,
yeah. And so I found two Summer Sam super fans because I didn't know they existed to help.
Wow, you're just bashing your guests from the get go. I see how I get how it is. All right,
but you're
the last of our kind.
You're the first people I've met who said they really like this movie, and it seems to get ignored, or people are like, oh, it's a bad Spike one. It's just. It doesn't seem...
Well, I think it's a little... It's different from what he was normally putting out. I think it kind of suffers from not having a single likable character in the entire movie. It's, it's not... I'm not going to try to tell you that it's like this, perfect gem of a movie. I mean, it's got problems, but I think that he accomplished what he set out to do was to create an atmospheric period piece. That period being 1977 in New York City. I think that you could definitely tell that he grew up in that time period. I mean, it just felt very distinctive and very real.
Yeah.
And I think that he I think that he accomplished what he meant to do with it.
Yeah. So, what's your history with Spike, Gina? Do you like his movies? Are you indifferent?
I do. I probably the first of his movies that I remember seeing. I think the first one I saw was School Days. I remember when that came out. I did like that one a lot, and then I saw Do the Right Thing. And then I kind of missed a lot of his kind of early 2000s output. Like, I think I saw Jungle Fever and a couple of the ones, but there were some that I missed. And then last year I saw Black Klansman, which I thought was one of the best movies of 2018. So, yeah, I mean, I accept that he could be a little hit or miss, but most of what I've seen from him have all landed well with me.
So you skipped She Hate Me?
I did skip She Hate Me.
You are.
I didn't hear good things about that. So.
You are not missing out.
I also skipped She Hate Me. Oh, wait.
No. Yeah, so Ben, what's your history with Spike?
Yeah, I'm not well-versed in him. I've seen Do the Right Thing and most recently Black Klansman and Summer of Sam, and that's pretty much it. I appreciate him most of all for his appearances on TCM. He introduced a series of movies, and he really won me over with the passionate way he spoke about things like A Face in the Crowd, which was a film that I watched immediately after and enjoyed a lot. So Like, I respect him as much as a scholar, as somebody who, I believe he taught at NYU. He put together an actually really compelling syllabus of world cinema that I've referred to a few times. And, like, on top of that, yeah, I've appreciated the films I've seen of him, but would like to see more.
Oh, yeah. Do the Right Thing is kind of like the one everyone starts with. Kind of for a reason. It's kind of best. It's kind of the best one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. But, it's not only like his best movie. It's probably one of the best movies of the 80s. So, I mean, that's kind of like one of those movies. It's like, okay, you haven't seen this yet. Let me sit you down so you can watch this.
Yeah. So,
I'd also point out that there are a few resonances between Do the Right Thing and Summer of Sam.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that they both take place during a heat wave where simmering tensions are brought to the boil. And also sports factors into both as a component of a racial identity.
Yeah. And, yeah, I have to say that it feels like Do the Right Thing circa the 70s, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Where Do the Right Thing wasn't. Trying not necessarily based off of anything in particular, where like this was like kind of same formula, but like you know, as you were saying, Gina, living in New York during the Summer of Sam killings.
Yeah, it's a very unique approach to an actual real life crime, in that it's kind of more, you know, how it was affecting people indirectly. Like, we don't get to know, I mean, we barely get to know the killer, David Berkowitz. He appears on screen maybe less than a half a dozen times, doesn't really have much in the way of dialogue. He's just, you know, he's kind of this, you know, much spoken about but rarely seen figure. We definitely don't get to know the victims or the victims' families. These are all people who were just indirectly impacted by this, you know, mysterious person going around and shooting people, basically just making out in their cars, which is basically how the real life case was. I mean, he had a very specific type of victim that he chose for this.
Yeah, and the dog sounded like John Turturro also.
It was the it was the voice of John Turturro that was him doing the voice of the dog.
Yeah, because Spike, he has to have John Turturro somewhere.
Yeah. And I think that he kind of took a literal approach to David Berkowitz's claim that his neighbor's dog was talking to him. I think that in retrospect, he was kind of making that up a little bit. But in this one, the dog is literally like just telling him to go out and kill people.
I actually thought that was an apt choice on his part, because it's not necessarily about the fact of David Berkowitz, but more about like the media figure that
right.
He developed.
Yeah, right. Like Jimmy Breslin, who frequently in real life reported on the crime, also appears in this. So it was basically, you know, how he's reporting it and how it played out. You know, if it had turned out a lot of it wasn't 100% accurate, not because he was lying, but because, you know, he had gotten, you know, some misinformation and most true crime stories as we know them don't actually play out the way they're reported. You know, like a good example would be the murder of Kitty Genovese, it was absolutely just, you know, just made up out of whole cloth what happened to her. Yeah. In this case, I mean, I think that the whole talking dog thing was just such a lurid detail that they really just jumped right on that and embellished it, even if it was just something that he kind of just said to make himself sound crazy so he wouldn't end up, you know, going to the electric chair or whatever.
Like, even now, that's the most dominant image most people have when they think of David Berkowitz.
Right. I mean, he's literally called Son of Sam because the dog's name is Sam.
Oh.
The dog's name was Harvey, actually. Yeah.
Oh, was it?
Owner
oh, okay.
of the dog was named Sam.
Right. Yes, you're right.
Yeah, like,
but yeah, but that's because of the dog that he got, that the press gave him the nickname Son of Sam.
Because, like, before I watched this, I'm not a true crime person. I don't know serial killers. So to me, like, Zodiac and Son of Sam were, like, the same thing. And then starting to, like, oh, I thought this was a Zodiac guy, and then that kind of took me a bit to realize Yeah.
Well, they actually have never found. Well, I mean, they kind of know who he is, but he's dead now. But they never actually captured the Zodiac Killer. But David Berkowitz is still alive. Ted Cruz. But yeah, he was not that old when he was when this happened. He was only in his mid to late 20s, maybe. So I mean, he's still alive.
Yeah, you go visit him.
Exactly.
Like, in some ways, you could say Zodiac and the Son of Sam are similar in the sense of them both courting media attention, but they're also perhaps inverses as well, because it feels to me like David Berkowitz was not as cerebral as the Zodiac Killer. I mean, all the killings
he was just poorly plotted.
It seems like he just wanted to kill brunette women just because, I don't know much about him, like, did he ever give a reason? Like, is it known, or is he? I don't know.
He said the dog told him to do it. He didn't really give. I mean, he killed a couple of men too, but it was always like couples that he killed.
All right. So, how do you guys want to handle this? Do you want to go like character by character, or like whatever? Because like it's kind of too big of a movie.
I think the reason why people may not like this movie is it is slightly mismarketed. I mean, again, you think it's going to be about the Son of Sam. You think it's going to be, you know, how the detectives are going to be tracking him down, like a standard true crime movie. But what it actually ends up being is very much about John Leguizamo's sex life, which is a little startling. Like, in rewatching it, I'm like, oh wow, this is like 75% of the plot is him constantly cheating on Mira Sorvino, who plays his wife. And then the other 25% is pretty much Adrian Brody's character, like, is, I forget where he was, but he comes back to this little, you know, very Italian American.
I think he was in Manhattan, but he moved out, got kicked out or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's talking with a British accent and dressed like a punk rocker, which, like, his friends just are not having that at all. I mean, I think he looks fucking great, but, you know,
but I wasn't a fan of the accent.
Well, like, the accent was pretty terrible.
Wrong about this movie? This is actually like the worst movie ever made. But he drops that.
I think he realizes that it's a little corny, and then he starts dating a girl in the neighborhood who has kind of a reputation for being a slut, and you know, so it's because of this somehow it's perceived that he might be the killer, because mostly because he's just suddenly so different from everybody now.
Right. Yeah, it's like. Okay, so, like, the one thing I want to get out of the way first is, like, the Italian accents, to me, seem cartoony, but I don't live in New York. Do those people really exist? Do they really talk like that?
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, I think it might be a little bit of an homage to Saturday Night Fever, because that was released roughly around the same time and took place in the same neighborhood, the whole, you know, Bay Ridge, which is, like, a big Italian-American neighborhood in Brooklyn. I mean, probably not so much now, but definitely in the 70s, you know, that, you know, the whole Sopranos, you know, bada-boom kind of thing, you know.
Okay, because, like, those accents,
would be
to
fairly
me,
authentic.
It took me out of it, because it's, like, just, to me, it sounds so much like a cartoon. Like, the Ayo Ma shit is, like,
well,
people
because some of the
like
also some of the actors aren't Italian Americans, so, you know, they you know, a couple, like, Adrian Brody is not Italian, John Leguizamo is not Italian, and I think that, you know, so it is an accent that sounds cheesy when it's not your own accent.
We're trying to figure out, me and Sarah watched it, if John Leguizamo was supposed to be Italian.
Yeah,
I didn't know. He's partly Italian in real life.
Oh, is he? Okay, I thought he
was... His grandfather is half Italian or something.
Oh, okay.
Like, his name is Vinny, but, you know, that could be... Yeah.
In the movie, I thought he was, like, adopted or something. Because, like, why is he with these Italians? I thought, like, New York is kind of weirdly segregated with, like, the neighborhoods, and why is this, like, Hispanic guy here? And it's like, oh, he's Italian? Sure, I guess so.
We could almost tell if he was Jewish or not, you know, with some of these scenes.
Okay, Jesus Christ. Yeah, you really have to be very interested in John Leguizamo's sex life too.
And I am.
Yeah, it's like I said earlier, that is a lot of the plot of this movie.
Yeah.
And I can see why it may have, like, people may be watching it was like, this wasn't what I signed up for. I wanted to see, you know, hard boiled New York detectives, you know, tracking down the serial killer.
Yeah.
And here we got, you know, Mira Sorvino, you know, getting into an argument because she claims she can smell another woman's vagina on him.
what's classic Italian actor Anthony LaPaglia actually up to going on? You know, nope, we're not going to find out.
No, they're it's a very minor part of the plot, which is, you know, I understand why he did that, and I think overall it does work, but the very few times he appears on screen, Michael Badalucco, he's fucking great. He looks like him. He's very creepy, but he gets almost nothing to do.
I've only ever seen that guy yelling. You know, he's gonna be like, "My name is George Nelson." No, but
yeah, I definitely picture. Yeah, I totally think of him in No Brother Where Art Thou, just, you know, leaning out the window and like shooting people and laughing. And all. I mean, he's been in other stuff, but that's probably what I know him best from. But he has a great presence in this. He's just not used very much.
Which one was him?
Yeah.
He was the son of Sam.
Oh, okay.
He was the crazy guy.
Yeah, see, that's how you don't remember who he is, because he's not in it that much.
Yeah, I thought you were talking about, like, one of the mobster people, because, like...
Oh, no.
Okay, so, like, I don't like the... besides, like, the accents, like, it, like, Spike's portrayal and, like, of sex in movies is odd, because, like, it's like, in here, it felt like he was, like, embracing, like, making a movie sexual, but at the same time, it felt like he was showing it as a sign of, like, oh, if certain types of sex is
taboo.
Is not taboo.
Well, it's
bad or, like, morally judging. It's like, are you trying to be judgy here? Are you trying to be celebratory? Like, I'm not sure where he was going with it.
Well, it's some point during the. Another thing that's hard to figure out is I. And again, like I said, this is not a perfect movie. I do have criticisms. Like, I don't know how old these characters are supposed to be. Like I would assume that, you know, because the actors are that age, that they're all in their late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
But Richie, the Adrian Brody's character, strikes me as if he was initially written to be a teenager. Because he's a male prostitute. He does this weird, like, strip routine in the middle of the movie, which is, like, very weirdly aggressive. And it's not sexy at all. Like, he's like, I'm like looking at the scene now, and he's just like tearing this mannequin apart. And I'm like, all right, I guess that's sexy, but it seems like Adrian Brody, he's about my age, so he would have been, again, in his late 20s when this movie was made, and it just seems like the character is meant to be a little younger.
Yeah, like, he's introduced, like, in his bedroom, and, like, broken guitar, so, like, he's kind of meant to be kind of teenager-y, but then...
Yeah, he seems a little old to be suddenly embracing being a punk rocker.
Yes, like... But then, like, his best friend, Vinny, seems to be, like, a established guy who is, like, can afford his own home and is married.
He's like a hairdresser, and it's like, you get the idea that these people have known each other since they were kids, and it's like, how old is everybody supposed to be?
Is this, like, a Gremlin situation where his best friend is, like, a kid?
Maybe, I don't know, but again, this montage, as weird as it is, it's very effective. It's just kind of, you know, you got people playing air guitar, and, like, people are getting beaten up, and John Leguizamo, his character is, you know, chronically unfaithful husband, but he's like really religious too, which is like, you know, it's just it's interesting that you know, you'd see the contrast in these characters. You know, they're out partying when they're also beating people up that they think might be the killer, and it's a very frenetically made movie.
Yeah, I was on a podcast talking about Cool World.
Oh, good heavens.
I volunteered for it because I find Bakshi very fascinating. But, like...
Sweet Jesus. Now you want to talk about a movie that's pure dog shit.
Oh, no, we trash it. I like some aspects of it, but overall...
The soundtrack is great, but everything else is just terrible.
I would not say that. I'd say some of the animation sequences are pretty good. Towards the end, listen to my episode on Below Freezing in a couple weeks when it comes out. But anyways, that movie is fucking frenetic, and like comparing to this, like, oh, this is so much calmer than what I just watched.
Well, let me ask you something. You guys, like, you don't seem to be as sold on this movie as Ben and I am. Why doesn't it work for you, or what doesn't work about it for you?
Joel,
I mean, for me personally, the main thing I have the problem with is that I feel like the tone kept changing in strange ways. Like we're talking about how it's not really about the Son of Sam, and like it's not merely a mystery, but there were some times where I feel like Spike wanted you to, you know, to feel like that was going on, like to feel like the neighborhood getting afraid and everything else like that. And it's like he had two movie ideas and the other one overpowered it. You know, the one about John Leguizamo, you know, and his hang-ups, and then also Adrian Brody and what's going on with him. And I thought that was actually a really interesting movie. Like, I wanted to watch that movie, but we kept getting interrupted with Summer of Sam, so I kept getting kind of distracted. So
that's a fair point. I can you know, say that I like the movie and totally get what you're saying there. It does definitely seem like he started it out as a straight retelling of Son of Sam and then decided, well, let's make it about, you know, these people, you know, in the neighborhood instead, like people who would be not necessarily directly impacted, but they would still feel the effects of it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it would have been more effective if there had been less David Berkowitz in the film, if we'd mainly heard about the killings secondhand through newspapers or radio reports or something, and he'd had gotten even less attention? We just focused more exclusively on Leguizamo and Brody's characters.
I don't even know. I don't, because I feel because of the amount of detail we get into those people's lives, we obviously become very invested in the characters. And they both go through these, like, good changes in their story, and they have to realize things about themselves. And then at the ending, you know, when Adrian Brody gets beaten, like, not to death, but it looks like it could have been, the movie just ends.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wait, we're not going to get a conclusion on this story, I guess. Okay, well, there's that guy telling me 1,000,000,000 stories, and thank you. Have a good one.
Like, ultimately, I think it's the story of a certain summer, and their lives continue on past the summer, but the summer has ended, and that's why it has that sort of abrupt conclusion to them.
Right. I just wasn't expecting David Berkowitz to shoot me through the screen, and that's what happened. It's weird.
Oh, you were wearing your 3D glasses for that one?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I bought a dog. It hasn't talked to me yet.
Spencer, what about you? Like, what doesn't necessarily work for this for you?
It's just kind of, like, typical Spike, super excessive, but kind of excessive in a way closer to, like, She Hate Me, where it's like, this is just too much stuff going on, and it's just, I find it hard to find anything to really sink my teeth into. And like the stuff with the Italians, like their accents, like it just sounds nitpicky, but like their cartoony accents really took me out of it every time you cut to them and them like talking like mobster shit, and it's like it just sounds so goofy to me, I just can't take it seriously
with that group of characters. The group of male friends who are always hanging out. Like, I feel like an element of the performance is posturing, like, very hyper-masculine posturing. Like, you see how angry they get at Ruby's ex-boyfriend, you know? And it's not because they're even angry. They're just putting on a show of being these macho, aggressive Italian guys who own their turf. And when they go out searching for the real Son of Sam killer, they're, again, like, putting on that hyper-masculine air, which is deliberately playing into a sort of Italian-American stereotype, being in control of their turf.
If I could point out, you were saying, Spencer, that too much is going on in the movie, and again, I would agree with that, but I will also say that it's very indicative and reflecting of the type of movies that were being made around this time. I would say that Quentin Tarantino ushered in the age of, you know, a lot of characters, a lot of little side stories, you know, a lot of, you know, fast cut, you know, very soundtrack driven, you know, crime movies. This was very much of its time, and I hate to keep bringing Zodiac up, but I feel like to a certain extent that Zodiac kind of brought that sort of style to an end and went and you kind of everything kind of turned to a more minimalist approach, where the, you know, the kind of the they allows the audience to kind of build up that sense of unease themselves rather than, you know, constantly just throwing image after image after image at you. So I would say more that he's just kind of really reflecting the types of movies that were being made at that time.
Well, yeah, I see that, but like I there's some Spike movies from his time that I love that are just as excessive, but just like Bamboozled. It's one of my favorite movies, period. But, like, that's dealing with, like, a topic I find very interesting. And this is kind of, like, getting to, like, serial killers, which I'm not as interested in. I'm almost tapping into it. But, like...
So it's your problem. No, I'm just kidding.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly if that's not your genre, then, yeah, you're not going to enjoy it. I mean, I'm kind of... At this point, I'm a little burned out on them, but, I mean, I have in the past very much enjoyed movies based on real life crimes, and I thought that this was a unique approach to it, and that's why I ended up really enjoying it.
I mean, it's like a slice of life of like this specific time in New York, but it also feels like it should have been maybe a couple movies or like a series because there's so much stuff. And like,
oh, it would make a great like limited series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like,
I totally agree with that.
Yeah, it felt too short. It's 2.5 hours, but I felt like there's more stuff here. But I feel like if it were maybe 3 hours, I like it more because more stuff would be fleshed out a bit more. But here it feels weirdly too much and too compact at the same time.
Yeah, that's a weird feeling. But there's other things that are irritating, but I think it's only because, Spencer, if I've been watching the Spike Lee movies, that are Spike-isms that we're kind of like, oh boy, this is going to be a thing.
You mean the
like,
sexism?
For some reason, every single movie, he's somehow managed to shoehorn in a lesbian scene full of nudity. And it's like, why, Spike? What's going on?
I mean,
I guess that's for him, like what feet are for Quentin Tarantino. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just also, a thing and he likes it, so who knows?
Big talk for the guy who discovered Doppelganger through Mr. Skin.
You know, I'm just saying, Spike. How about a couple of still images? No.
yeah. Lesbians seems to be a recurring thing, and it's like always. I remember, not release episode, but the Sweet Blood Jesus episode. Which, spoiler alert, Joel and I are defenders of that movie. It's we like it. It's not. I think it deserves a better reputation than it gets.
Yep.
That one I
have not seen. I have seen Ganja and Hess, which apparently it is a loose remake of, but I have not seen that.
You'll hear an episode like how close it is and not close. But the lesbian stuff, it's always like hyper. It's just like kind of masturbatory where it's like this doesn't need to be here. I'm not trying to be a prude. It's kind of like this is just like one thing too much.
No. I get that, and a lot of directors don't do sex scenes or sexuality very well. Spike Lee is one of them. Stanley Kubrick is another one who never did like sexuality in a way that wasn't very sterile and uncomfortable, and just most of them just really aren't good at it.
Yeah, like it's always lipstick lesbians. We had a guest, Marcus Penn, who thinks he's in every Spike movie, and like he says like it kind of shows up a lot. It's always like hyper feminine, very conventionally attractive lesbians every time. And it's just kind of like this male fantasy thing that he keeps forcing into his movies over and over again.
Like in this particular case, though, I did think the scene was appropriate and perhaps even necessary for the conflict between Deanna and Vinny, because he is trying to, pursue this male fantasy, and they end up at that club, Plato's Retreat, and he has it fulfilled with Deanna, his wife, and ultimately he finds that, like, what perhaps he might have thought was appealing to him is actually repulsive, and he recoils from it, and then they have that fight in the car where he calls her a dyke or something like that, and then she challenges his own sexuality.
Yeah, like, and like, this is going to She Hate Me. She Hate Me ends with, like, the fulfilling, like, the whole male fantasy lesbian bullshit, and it's like, but not in a negative way. It's like, oh yeah, it's his reward at the end of the movie for getting lesbians pregnant with his big black penis, because that's what the movie is about.
Sure. Like, I haven't seen that movie, but it sounds like it has a different outcome than what we see here, where, like, yeah. I feel in Summer of Sam it is surfacing the plot.
Yeah, here it is more, and like it's their whole.
I mean, it is. It's just like, of course. This when I saw it, that was my reaction. Of course.
The
one issue that I do have with the movie to a certain extent is I find myself thinking, am I supposed to care about these characters? It's like they're not. Very. I mean, I guess the one that the character that the audience is maybe supposed to be most sympathetic with would be Ruby, which is Adrian Brody's character's girlfriend,
who played by Jennifer Esposito.
Jennifer Esposito in a role that was originally supposed to be played by Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Oh, wow.
If you can believe that, yep.
Buffy. That's weird.
Because Jennifer Esposito was supposed to be Deanna, which was eventually given to
that would have made
more
sense
Serbina.
For Deanna.
But yeah, I think she's the one who the audience is supposed to feel kind of most connected to, because she's just kind of got this bad reputation. She's not really a bad person. She just sleeps around, which of course, in the 70s, it was still considered a big deal. But I mean, nobody else in this movie is particularly a likable or engaging character. I mean, you are right that, oh goodness, sorry about that.
Is Adrian Brody like the most likable?
I mean, he's posturing, and again, I feel like the character is supposed to be much younger than he comes off on screen. I feel like he's supposed to be 18 or 19 at the outside. So it's weird to see an actor in his late 20s, playing a character who is clearly still trying to figure out his identity.
You know, he still lives at his home with his ma and
Mike Starr,
the guy from Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah, Mike Starr. Okay, that character is okay.
I like him a lot.
And that character,
I want to know their story too.
Yeah, he ultimately ends up saving Richie's life at the end.
Oh yeah. Oh, he's kind of Mike Starr to save the day.
he's the real star of the film.
Or beat you senseless, depending, because he plays either one of these roles. He's either, kind of a goofy dad or just a total thug.
I think we're getting the best of both worlds with this performance here, because he's got his gun, but he's also got a big heart.
Yeah. And he plays air guitar with a broom, which is great.
Yeah.
So another series of parts that don't really make sense, like they could have been excised from the movie, in my opinion, is I was making that joke about Anthony Paglia, but Ben Gazzara, like, they could have excised all of his scenes with his goofy mafia dudes, but I love to see Ben Gazzara, so I don't know you know, I got mixed feelings on the whole thing, but they don't really end up doing anything. And also, Ben never gets out of a chair, so.
Well, I mean, he doesn't have to. He's Ben Gazzara.
That's true.
You know, this...
I mean, if you were Ben Gazzara, would you ever get out of a chair?
No, that's true.
He's got a rider in his contract. Like, you want me to get out of the chair, you got to pay extra.
You make me do this accent? Yeah, I'm not getting out of the chair.
Yeah, I feel like in the script, that character was probably described as a Burt Young type.
Was Burt Young still... Is he dead?
Burt Young is still alive.
Oh, I thought he died in the 80s.
No, he actually had a small role in a Russian Doll on Netflix recently.
Oh, yeah. He's going to outlive Sylvester Stallone.
He was, if you can believe this, Spencer is someone there to hold your hand, because when he did the first Rocky movie... Mm-hmm. He was only in his 30s.
Oh.
If you could believe that.
I've never seen Rocky. You've only seen Rocky IV.
It's hard living.
Well, I mean, but you know what he looks like. You know what I'm talking about. He's only in his 30s.
Yeah. Wow. The secret to aging well is to look old in your 30s and then just stay there.
Yeah, because he's looked exactly the same since 1985. So, you know. Joke's on us, you know. Yeah, I mean, he looks great for being almost 80 now.
Yeah. So, like, the soundtrack is all songs from that were released, I think, that year, not this later summer.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, Psycho Killer, I didn't know that was a 70s song. I always assumed that was 80s.
Nope.
I remember hearing some trivia that. That was actually an anachronism. That song is inappropriate, but the others are.
Yeah. Well, I looked it up, and if I remember correctly, it was came out December of that year, not their summer.
Mm-hmm.
But still,
well, we can't all be Stranger Things when it comes to period accuracy.
No, and like the soundtrack, like a lot of Spike things is very on the nose, and it's full of like the very on the nose things like the. Constant close-ups of the dead end sign in the neighborhood, where it's like, "Yep, I get it. It's like a dead end because this neighborhood sucks, or something." Or for
that's what I'm talking about. Why I feel like the characters were all originally written to be younger than they actually are, because again, the whole idea of you're never going to get out of your and again, this was a big thing with I feel. And I can't be the first person to have pointed this out. I feel like a lot of this is an homage to Saturday Night Fever.
Oh yeah, because he even dressed like Tony
a lot
Nero.
Of that was, yeah, and a lot of that was him wanting to get out of his little crappy working class Brooklyn neighborhood. But the character of Tony Manero was actually supposed to be 19. He was a teenager, and I don't know why he decided to age them up. But they still come off as very, you know, like a bunch of disaffected teenagers. So I also think it's funny that in both movies, like, you know, because I actually live in Brooklyn, and I think it's funny that in the 70s, apparently, like, the idea of just, you know, moving out of Brooklyn and going to, like, Manhattan was, like, you know, how now we would look at, like, you know, moving from, like, you know, Florida to Texas. It's just this, like, extravagantly, you know, far-off land that you really have to, you know, not everybody can make it there, and it's just very funny to me that that's how it's portrayed.
Hey, I ain't gonna leave the neighborhood. Come on. Jeez.
Come on, I got the best gabagool in five boroughs.
What do you want to go over there, those weirdos? You want to be a weirdo, do you?
I have a dumb question. Is gabagool a real thing?
I believe it is a thing. Yes. Oh. I want to make sure I am not Italian. I do not want any angry letters, but it's a lunch meat.
Oh, okay.
It's the actual word is capicola. But it's what people, because of the odd sort of, and Spencer, you mm-hmm. have, you know, traveled somewhere in the Philadelphia area. You'll note that people put a strange inflection, yeah, like mozzarella, it's mozzarella.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Ricotta is rigote. It's a real thing. It is honestly a real thing. I have heard people talk like that. So, you know, gabagool is, you know, it's a lunch meat. It's instead of saying capicola.
Okay.
Now you know.
Yeah.
All I stunned everybody to silence with that information.
Yeah.
You don't know. You're just sitting there processing this.
The movie is complete.
I'm Grubhub ordering some gabagool.
Yeah, like it. I mean, like it just touches on like some racial stuff with like the like mm-hmm. casual racism of New York of like you're forced to live with other types of people, but you can still be ignorant and bigoted. Which is, it's still an interesting thing to show.
Well, I think that one thing that he did get right was how very, very segregated neighborhoods were. And it's and still in the 70s, I mean, they still are to a certain extent, but certainly in the 70s, like, there were just certain neighborhoods that you did not go into and that other people did not enter into your neighborhood. I feel like, you know, he could have explored that a little more, but I'm kind of glad he didn't, because again, then you have a third movie.
Yeah.
And like, part of the crux of the film is how isolated these characters are from everything.
Right. I mean, they think they are so stuck in this neighborhood that, right. You know, they find no way, you know, they can't leave their neighborhood. It's just mm-hmm. a neighborhood.
Yeah. And we see Bed-Stuy in the new segment with Spike Lee playing John Jeffries, but that's not something that the main characters directly encounter. It's something that they only see in television, even though Bed-Stuy is not that far from where they actually are.
And he interviews his sister in it.
Oh.
The woman with the big hair and that dark skin, that's Spike's sister. She's in mm-hmm. a lot of his movies in bit parts. Wait, Ben, do you live in New York?
What was that?
Do you live in New York, too?
No, I was born in New York City, actually, and then I lived in Long Island until my preteens. Then I moved to New Jersey. Currently, I'm living in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. But, like,
So, as a Massachusetts resident, when that poor punk was called a Beantown cocksucker, I took that very personally.
No. You felt that in your soul.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's feel like another callback to the right thing of like the Celtics fan.
Celtics, yeah.
And I hope Spike never hears this, but I'm a Celtics fan, and I feel like he'd have an issue.
What the hell are you admitting this on a podcast about Spike Lee, for God's sake?
Yeah, but Gina, does like the geography of like of the movie make sense? Like, is it accurate to New York? Like, is there any like glaring like someone takes a corner and they go from Long Island to Brooklyn or something, or is it?
It's not. It's things are a little further away from that, but also at the same time, you know, it's not very far. It doesn't take very long to get from Brooklyn to Manhattan. Mm-hmm. So it's again, it's very funny to me that these were considered like, you know, these far off places. I mean, from where I live, you can get to Brooklyn, you can get to Manhattan in about 20 minutes. Now, granted, you know, I was a child when this movie took place. I was not living here at the time, so I'm assuming that the public transportation system was, you know, not as great now, but it's probably a little better than it was then. But I think certainly the whole, getting back to the idea of the neighborhoods being very segregated, I think there was, you know, a certain sense of that you had to go out of your way to avoid going through certain neighborhoods, like even if you were just on the train or the bus, so it probably, you know, was more complicated than it might seem. I mean, I think that, what he's getting across really well, and again, because he would have been in his teens, I guess, when this movie took place.
He's like my parents' age, so he would have been, I think, 18, 19, maybe a little younger.
Right. I mean, he really did get down that New York was a shithole in the 70s. It was absolutely, I mean, for anybody who watched this movie and liked it, a very good nonfiction book is called Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning, which is a book about major events that took place in New York in 1977, and that included the blackout, which lasted about 3 days.
Jesus.
If you can imagine what that must be like in the dead middle of summer. Son of Sam, and there was some local politics scandals, and just it was a shithole. It was crime ridden.
I've been working on an article off and on for a little bit, and it requires me looking up the crime stats in New York at this time. I'm writing about Bad Lieutenant because that's kind of about shitty New York also, and. Right. The crime stats at this point, it was like 2 out of 10 people were raped or killed. It was kind of a bit higher than I expected. It really was a complete shithole.
You could see why people would not leave their neighborhood. Because, I mean, yeah, these people, you know, that you hang out with are goons and they're violent and they hold you down, but they're also probably going to keep you safe, too.
Yeah, like, the vigilante justice here with, like, the Italian boys is, well, I guess they're a mob, technically, or something. It was never 100% clear. I guess they were a mob, but, like, they, you know, it's clear that, like, they keep the neighborhood safe, but they also, you know, will fuck you up if they get, you know, even the slightest wrong idea about you. And it seemed like...
You're talking about the... Guys, Vinny and
Vinny's,
Vinny hangs out with.
Yeah, those dudes. Were they?
No, they were just a bunch of mafia people.
Just drug dealers.
I'm getting characters mixed up. Like the Italians kind of blended to me. I'm unsure who they were.
Vinny's friends were just a bunch of books. I mean, they
who were
wearing red? They're Marios. If they're wearing green, they're
Ben Gazzara.
Then who was Ben Gazzara? Was Ben Gazzara in his...
That was unassociated Italian.
As Joel pointed out, his character was kind of superfluous and mm-hmm. just kind of added some color to the proceedings. I don't know if in real life any mafia purported to put out a hit on anybody who if they knew who the Son of Sam was. I'm pretty sure that was probably for dramatic purposes.
I guess Italians all look the same to me because I thought they were mafia too.
They all look like John Leguizamo.
I could tell him apart.
They were sort of drafted by the mafia to be part of this gang searching for the Son of Sam killer. But
like
I don't
doing
think
like
that
a neighborhood,
were.
Like a sort of
exactly neighborhood watch,
neighborhood watch kind of thing. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But they were not made men.
Oh, all right. Maybe I need to watch this again because like it's just so much. So much Italian.
There's
shit.
There's a lot happening in it. Yeah. Like I said, I don't disagree that it throws a lot at you. I just think more of it works than doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I'm still kind of down the middle. Like I feel like seeing the punk culture of that time, like CBGB, and you know punk better than I do, Gina. Like was there a band playing before? Was that a real band, like a reference to something, or was that just a random band?
I think it was just kind of generic quote unquote punk music. It is interesting that if you look at the soundtrack, there isn't actually any punk music on it. It's all mostly kind of disco and kind of what they used to call MOR, middle of the road, kind of bland adult contemporary music, which again is accurate because more people were listening to that than they were listening to punk at the time. It's punk is one of those things that we like to kind of kid ourselves in retrospect that way more people were into than they actually were, but it didn't really become a huge thing until kind of after the fact, really. Like I kind of don't think that Spike Lee actually knew any punk rockers when he was a teenager.
I highly doubt that too.
Yeah, I will say though that the scene in CBGB's where they perform a song to David Berkowitz's letter, like that was one of my favorite parts of the movie.
Yeah, they're like
I thought it worked surprisingly well as.
And again, I don't know if that was based on a real event. I'm gonna guess probably not, but it's just so weird and almost kind of crudely funny, and it seems like a very nihilistic punk rock thing to do. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I feel like that's one of the moments in the film where all these disparate elements sort of dovetail together. Because, like we've said, the Son of Sam killings are sort of on the periphery, but in that moment we're seeing that they're having a direct impact on the culture that these characters have oriented their lives around. It's really speaking to their sense of alienation and anger and angst.
What's this? It's about the punk stuff too. I like seeing like the. Was this also kind of like hinting at the death of disco too? Because like this is late 70s, so like.
It wasn't. This was supposed to be like 77, 78. It wasn't quite dead yet.
Okay. Because it was like the disco club they go to, local one, going from really popular to really kind of desolate. I wasn't sure if that was. Just because of the killings, or maybe it was
that,
also...
That's the impression I got.
Or maybe
Studio 54 was still going.
Yeah, I think that they were trying to kind of go on with things as normal, and a lot of people were not at that point. So yeah, I think that was more indicative of people being afraid to go out.
Okay.
Yeah. And in terms of commentary on disco, I felt like Spike was more so trying to create an interesting juxtaposition between, you know, the frothy pop culture and the more visceral and violent events that were actually occurring in real life.
Yeah.
Like, in the very first killing that we see, ABBA is playing in the background. I think it was, like, Fernando or something from the Mamma Mia soundtrack, and then these poor women get their heads blown off.
Yeah,
which is always a. It's to me, I do kind of have an enjoyment of juxtaposition between song and what's happening in a movie. Mm-hmm. Like one thing I always love is when a movie ends on a down note, but it has a kind of upbeat song on the closing credits. Like two examples that I love are Blood Simple, the Coen Brothers movie, ends with. It's a Temptation, a Four Tops song. It's very cheerful and upbeat. And then a more recent example would be Midsummer, which, despite everything that happens in it, it ends on this sort of, you know, 60s kind of, you know, it's a sad song, but it's sort of has a sort of upbeat kind of, you know, sunshiny 60s sound to it. It's called The Sun Isn't Going to Shine Anymore. And it works really, really well. And I like when people, you know, make that, you know, sort of contradictory music to action choice.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now I feel like that's an ongoing motif with John Leguizamo's character, Vinny, because he's so immersed into disco lifestyle, but over the course of the film, his private life completely deteriorates. But at the same time, he's still being surrounded by this like upbeat music, even as he's arguing with his wife, and she's calling him a linguini dick motherfucker.
Because they're Italian!
Yeah.
Yeah, I like the juxtaposition of the, I think it was the, not Willie Mays, was it Willie Mays?
Reggie Jackson.
The Reggie Jackson audio with David Berkowitz patrolling a neighborhood, and like when he gets the hits a home run, he kills a couple, and it's real graphic, and it's like, oh, that's just a beautiful sequence.
Sure. And then completely true to life, because, of course, those two things were happening simultaneously.
That was something that was directly from a real-life event, He kind of cherry-picked real-life things and then dramatized a lot of the rest of it, but it to me, it feels kind of seamless, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the hairdresser thing felt like a reference to Shampoo, because he's also fucking his clients.
Who's played by his boss is played by B.B. Newirth, Lilith Crane, which cracks me up.
Hmm. Yeah, but Spike clearly loves movies, and he'll throw in like some references and shit, like Bamboozled. I think Bamboozled is informed a bit by Facing the Crowd and Network and other stuff, and there are some direct references to those movies, and like this felt like like Shampoo and I heard on another one, I forgot what it was. A Saturday Night Fever.
Saturday Fever, definitely Saturday Fever is a huge
And maybe there
on
was
this.
Like a, I don't know, maybe there was like a punk reference to like some punk thing that he was aware of, but like it felt like the punk, the whole storyline with Adrian Brody was kind of referencing something that I just wasn't sure what exactly.
Well, there's a couple. There was a documentary about punk music called "The Decline of Western Civilization" that I feel that he certainly the look that he chose for Adrian Brody and the fake accent might have been lifted a little bit from that. And also, I think it might have been a little bit of I don't know if you've ever seen Sid and Nancy. Mm-hmm. That's I think that's probably that's also some influence on it.
Yeah. And like the, I guess him going to porn, kind of like going to reference maybe a kind of a nod to hardcore that would have been around this time, I think.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, that was a little the movie kind of lost me when Richie, Adrian Brody's character, gets into stripping and being a prostitute, because I feel that was very much Spike saying, you know, let me make this a little more lurid. Because for one thing, I mean, he's not getting a lot of action looking like that. You know, he does not look like a what you would expect a male prostitute whose clients are other men to look like. I don't imagine he would get a lot of interest. Mm-hmm. And although, who could say, because Dee Dee Ramone was very famously, before he joined the Ramones, a male prostitute. Mm-hmm. Wrote a whole song, 53rd and 3rd, is about his experience being a male prostitute. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, who can say for certain people's, I'm not going to judge people's tastes, but that part seemed a little wedged in for, you know, let's make this a little, you know, a little more sleazy. Yeah. And again, this the scene where he's supposed to be doing some sort of, I guess, you know, strip routine, and it just gets very artsy and very weird. And I'm like, okay, Spike, what are you doing with him, you know, having this mannequin on stage and he's like tearing to pieces?
Yeah,
with his little booty shorts on.
Yeah, that whole thing with like his routine felt like he's trying to be like Dress Franco with like because Dress Franco would always have like a dance like kind of stripper routine in his movies, and Dress Franco knew how to film those, and this is like you're really trying way too hard here, Spike. Yeah, you don't know what you're doing.
You're overthinking it. They just want to see his dick, man. Come on.
Yeah, I think.
And apparently, he's pretty hung, according to Michael. I can't remember the guy. The lights guy who also co-wrote the movie.
The guy from The Sopranos.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember anybody's name anymore. But yeah. No, I think that they.
You know,
Imperioli. I was gonna say Rispoli, which there is another actor named Michael Rispoli, and he's in the movie too, but it's not the same. Not who you're talking about, but I think that the main point of him destroying this mannequin is because Spike didn't trust the audience to understand that he was not happy to be able to be a male prostitute. So, you know, I mean, I suppose some people are. You know, again, I'm not going to judge, but I mean, I think it would be safe to assume that he would feel some level of shame and having to do it without having to angrily destroy a mannequin on stage.
Yeah. And he also, it's kind of barely alluded to, but he gets into, like, you know, fucking his girlfriend on camera. And, it's kind of not really talked about. It's kind of shown up in, like, a montage. And it's like, oh, they're watching them, they're watching themselves in a porn theater. Okay. And it's, like, never really... I don't think, like, that's one of the big reveals. I think the only big reveal to, like, his friends is, like, he's a stripper, and that's about it.
Yeah, I mean, we get that these characters are sort of on a downward spiral, that as things in the city are you know, kind of going, get, you know, flying out of control, so are these characters' personal lives, and you're definitely right that it's not subtle about that. Not unless I would never claim that it is. Listen, I just think that aspect of it, certain things he could have left to the audience to figure out for themselves. That I will say, but again, most of it kind of works for me.
I mean, yeah. In terms of the function of that whole subplot, I feel like it speaks to something that, like, I hear people talk about when they talk about old New York, how there used to be porno theaters and strip clubs, and it was, like, a whole much more, like, lurid environment than there is today. And so I feel like maybe that's
something Spike Lee was trying to illustrate.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and just going back to the film references, one thing I noticed when looking at Wikipedia is that Michael Imperioli's character was named Midnight, which is probably like a reference to Midnight Cowboy or something, right?
Probably.
I mean, he's got that cowboy hat and everything.
Joel, did you pay attention to who got the Spike Lee, the dolly shot thing he always does?
It's Bobby, wasn't it?
Hmm?
Bobby the fairy?
Yep, Bobby got it, which I was like, huh. I was expecting, like, Adrian Brody to get that, or Vinny.
Well, there's also a part where Vinny and the main Italian goofball, he's, like, trying to convince him that Richie was the one, and they do another one of those shots there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But still, it's been like, oh, Bobby gets the first one, his character we get to meet this way. It's just kind of like...
His name is Bobby the fairy, you gotta see him fly.
He's important.
Yeah,
important character.
Yeah, he shows up in what, 3 scenes? Something like that.
I don't even want to talk about him.
was it offensive or was it? I don't know. Was that offensive? I mean,
it was a stereotype at the very least, but.
Yeah. Like it's...
I mean, one thing that was interesting to me is later on when the group of Italian men are roaming around looking for the Son of Sam killer and beating people up. At one point, they beat up somebody who had previously harmed Bobby. And they say, nobody messes with Bobby O'Fieri. That was a really interesting moment for me because they treat him so poorly personally. But at the same time, because he's part of their neighborhood, they evidently feel some sort of like protectiveness for him.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody messes with him but us, you know, that sort of thing.
And that's definitely a thing, you know, that's definitely a dynamic with young male friend groups is you got the hierarchy and you got the one guy that everybody picks on, but nobody else allowed to pick on him but them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like, one thing I did like, I like the look of it. It's shot very well. It's very, very striking. And it's shot by Ellen Kuras. Who did Bamboozled, which also looks very striking, and she did Eternal Sunshine, The Spotless Mind. So, like, her filmography is full of, like, she's a very great DP. And, like, if you see her name pop up at Chanter's Art, it will look great.
Yeah, I mean, I think he got, you know, all the details correct. I think he did a really great job with just establishing time and place, which, you know, a lot of movies that take place in the past are just like the 70s. Mm-hmm. But I think it's, you know, it's, you know, so they'll show people in bell bottoms and they'll show people, and it's just a sort of, you know, vast expanse of the 70s. And this is a very, very specific moment. This may be even just a couple of weeks in it was the summertime. It goes hence the title. So it was a very specific place and time, and I think he absolutely nailed that part of it.
Mm.
Like if you were to show me this movie and say when and where is this supposed to take place, I would say, oh, that's Brooklyn sometime in the late 70s.
Yeah.
We're not selling you guys on this, are we?
No,
I was gonna say
I like
back
it
back when Italians were allowed to walk the streets.
Yeah. No, I don't know. Overall, I like it more than like She Hate Me, but that's not saying much. But I don't know.
No, I think this is like in the ones that we've watched so far. This is middle of the road. Like there are a lot of things I did enjoy.
Yeah,
I did enjoy all the performances.
For the most part.
Honestly, when it comes to Spike's treatment of women typically in the movies, that like he wasn't making these the two main female characters to be like evil or anything, especially I mean, you can't help but feel sympathy for Mira Sorvino, you know, with what goes down with her, like everything she has to deal with.
Yeah.
And I think Jennifer Esposito's character is almost not really a character, but I think that also is kind of goes along with it because she starts, you know, glomming onto what Richie's doing.
I wish Mira Sorvino would have had more to do besides be like the spouse of someone who's always unfaithful.
Do you like suffer the suffering wife? Yeah.
Yeah, which is like Spike in women roles is usually kind of not great.
Well, I think that if I recall correctly, were they supposed to have been together since like high school? I feel like that was mentioned they'd been like childhood sweethearts or something like that. And then I think that, you know, the movie, probably not as much as it could have, but it definitely touches upon the idea of staying with people, whether they're your friends or your romantic partner, out of obligation, because you've just known them for so long. And like, particularly with the character Richie, you know, you get to the point where these characters are all in their 20s, let's say early 20s for argument's sake, and they just have nothing in common with each other anymore. And even John Leguizamo and his friends, they don't really seem to like each other very much. I mean, there's definitely a hostility there, like just this undercurrent of dislike. And I think that with him and Mira Sorvino's character, again, they've been together so long, and then because he's, you know, in addition to being chronically unfaithful, he's also, you know, a Catholic, so he's kind of, you can't divorce her because this is still the 70s and people just, you know, thought it was more shameful to be divorced than to be in, you know, a marriage where you're constantly cheating on your wife.
So Vatican II happened already, so like divorce was quote-unquote okay.
It was and it wasn't. Certain community, like Italian and Irish Catholic communities, it was still very much frowned upon. But yeah, I think that the movie touches a little bit upon, you know, kind of, you know, staying in certain people's orbits because you feel obligated to, or because you've never known anybody else. And again, that sense of being trapped. Just, you know, you're obviously not happy, you're not comfortable where you are. But, you know, when someone dares to, you know, step out of their lane like Richie does, it results in pretty much rage. I think that they're less. I don't think they actually do believe that Richie is the son of Sam. I think they're just looking for an excuse to beat the shit out of him.
Yeah, and like that kind of touches with like their reaction to seeing a drag queen at Club 54. Like they're like kind of country hicks going to like the big city. Because you're like, hey, that's a man. And like,
yeah, well, you wouldn't have seen that. You would not have seen that. And like, certainly not in Bay Ridge or anywhere in like the little, you know, outlying neighborhoods in Brooklyn at the time. You would not have seen that.
And when I like go to the punk club, they're like, who are these people? Like, you get this real sense of, you know, they have never left their neighborhood once. It seems like.
Why would they need to? They just, you know, it's a very, I mean, my grandfather was very much a you know, big believer in the idea of, you know, why would you need to leave the neighborhood? You have everything you need right here. It just, you know, there's no perceived reason to leave.
Yeah. Turns out New York is a pretty diverse place. Am I right?
It is now. It is now, not so much in the 70s.
All right,
going back to the female characters, I think there's also a very obvious Madonna whore dichotomy going between Diana and Ruby. Yeah. When you look at the conversation between the two of them, when Diana asks Ruby about her prior relationship with Vinny and how they had like a very sexual relationship, and that was a component that Diana and Vinny themselves don't share. I think that really illuminates what Vinny's problem is. Mm-hmm. The fact that he sees Diana as his wife, as a potential mother, means that he can't treat her like a sexual object like he did with Ruby in the past and like he does now with the women that he cheats with. And when he does find himself in an environment where he can treat her that way, it completely destroys his sense of her as the Madonna, as like the pure, untouched wife and potential mother, and that's why they end up fighting on the way back from Plato's retreat. Like, suddenly she's a whore to him. And
I think like,
that's problematic, certainly, but also
I think he does.
I feel like Spike is trying to undercut that too. I think we're supposed to see that Vinny's being short-sighted and like even a hypocrite. Like, there's that moment where he says, "I can't be a whore because I'm a man," and obviously that's the stupidest fucking thing he says in the entire movie, because he very clearly is a whore.
If Spike was trying to take the easy exit on that whole conversation, then Leguizamo would have convinced her that she was the one who did something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And she does end up standing with her principles, because Vinny could go fuck himself.
I don't know.
It, like Joel was saying earlier, like it's kind of down the middle. Things I like, things I don't like.
Yeah, I wouldn't tell somebody not to watch it or anything like that. This is definitely, you keep bringing up She Hate Me, and like even I think She Hate Me has some things that are interesting to talk about, at least. I don't think this is a bad movie in any sense.
Oh, no. Like, this is a well-made movie. Like, Spike is a true, craftsman. Like, he knows how to make a movie look good and move at a good pace and, like, has good sense of, like, montage and shit. And, like, he's a goddamn professional. And, you know, it's not a long 2.5 hours. Like, I think it's paced really well. And like,
I think that an interesting bit of trivia that possibly we could wrap it up with is that it remains the movie that uses the word fuck the most times. According to IMDb, it is said 326 times for an average of 2.29 times per minute.
That's a lot.
I didn't notice.
Yeah, this didn't make money, but Spike movies don't make money usually. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I think Black Klansman did pretty good, but overall, he's like the Coen brothers. The movies don't do a lot in the box office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think like Black Klansman, Inside Man are only like recent ones that made money, and that might be it, which is kind of saying a lot because it's like been over 10 years since his last movie to make money. But, let's see. Oh, yeah, and there was, like, a montage to a Who song.
Yes, Bob O'Reilly.
That, to me, was like, oh, this feels like I'm watching CSI. And I was waiting for, like, a pun at the end of it. I don't remember what CSI Son of Sam episode. anyway, so, if you're listening and you're still on the fence about it, give it a shot. It's definitely, you know, it's a Spike movie. It's definitely worth watching. If there's something you don't like, there's something you will like.
Mm-hmm. And if you happen to have a John Leguizamo fetish, this is the movie for you.
Actually, I think Romeo plus Juliet is the movie for you. But after that check this out.
That's a good point. Yeah, definitely watch Romeo and Juliet. Then this, because he's not sexy in this, but he's sexual.
I mean, he says so. "I'm coming" way too much. I've seen.
he's a total fucking scumbag in this movie. Total fucking scumbag.
I mean, I feel like Romeo plus Juliet is the movie you watch if you don't like Leguizamo, because he gets killed in it.
Yeah, but he has so much charisma before he does get killed.
That's true.
Yeah, so I believe you guys have other 1999 movies.
Ben, do you want to go first?
Sure thing. The first one I have to recommend is Takashi Miike's Audition. A very cool movie about a morally suspect man who holds a fake acting audition in order to find himself a girlfriend or wife. Unfortunately, the woman that he settles on proves to be a little more than he bargained for. It's a very subversive and interesting take on what could otherwise be a typical rom-com premise, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I don't recommend watching it when you're tired. I did, and I fell asleep. it's not a fast-moving movie, but...
Sure. I mean, it's got a slow start, but when it gets going, it really gets going.
Yeah, I woke up later, but it's definitely not a midnight movie. You want to be awake for, like, the build-up and to, like, the finale and all that.
Yeah. Second movie I'd recommend, Idle Hands, starring Devon Sawa. It's a sort of horror comedy in which a lazy stoner's left hand gets possessed by the devil and goes on a killing spree. It features some very funny physical comedy with regards to Devon Sawa's evil possessed hand. Also has a Seth Green and that guy from Daredevil who played Foggy Nelson as zombies. Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that one.
Oh,
have
you guys seen it? No. The guy you're talking about. I have his name. I forgot it.
Third one I'd recommend is a Japanese punk rock zombie movie called Wild Zero. Have you guys heard of that one?
Wild Zero. I covered that on PDS MIOS.
Awesome. Yeah, it's like a 90-minute music video where these guys who look like the Japanese Ramones or something go around and battle zombies in the midst of an apocalypse. They have inexplicable superpowers. They're able to, like, throw guitar picks like lightning bolts, and things are constantly on fire. There's a drinking game where you take a drink every time someone says the words rock and roll, combs their hair, a head explodes, or something gets lit on fire. And if you actually played that game, you would die of alcohol poisoning by the end of the movie. So I don't recommend doing that, but I do recommend watching the movie. It's a lot of fun. At the very least, watch the trailer on YouTube. Like, that on alone is a blast.
And I recommend...
Wild Zero is a must-see.
Definitely.
And for me, like I said earlier, what movies were released in 1999... Every fucking movie was released in 1999. It was such a huge year for movies that there was actually a book put out recently about it. I believe it's called The Best Movie Year Ever. So I was trying to go for a few less obvious choices for mine. So what I was going to suggest, my first choice would be the movie Election. Which is a movie about a race for class president in a high school, which goes a little bit awry. It stars Reese Witherspoon as a type A high school student, and Matthew Broderick as the sort of befuddled school teacher who sort of, they kind of have this weird sort of energy with each other. It's not exactly, he wants to sleep with her, but not either. And it's based on a book by Tom Perrotta, who wrote The Leftovers and the book Little Children. Thankfully, this is not as depressing as either of those books and the subsequent movie and TV series that was based on it are. But it's very weird and very darkly funny. Another movie I would recommend is a horror movie that got a little bit lost in the shuffle of The Sixth Sense, and that is Stir of Echoes, with Kevin Bacon as a man who becomes psychically linked with the victim of a murder. It's got a very good cast. Ileana Douglas, I believe, is his sister-in-law, who is a psychic and sort of draws him into this sort of connection with this dead girl. Very spooky, very atmospheric. Is it as good as The Sixth Sense? No, but I think it is about as equally worthy of your time to watch it if you just seek it out. And then my last pick would be The Talented Mr. Ripley, which stars Matt Damon, Jude Law, Gwyneth Paltrow, and the greatest of all time, Philip Seymour Hoffman, who plays, again, like John Leguizamo, and is a total fucking scumbag. And he's just so good, and he's so hammy and enjoying himself in just this, playing this supporting character who unfortunately exits the movie far too soon. But this is based on a series of novels by Patricia Highsmith about a young man who enters high society by assuming other people's identities. In this case, he tries to assume the identity of Jude Law after he murders him. It's a very long movie. It's very slow moving. And yet, when you're about halfway through it, you find yourself thinking, I got to see how the rest of this movie plays out. It's just, it's a very dry and fascinating mystery. And I would definitely recommend that to anybody who has not seen it yet. And also Baby Geniuses. Everybody should watch Baby Geniuses.
Yeah, late era Bob Clark is great.
Yeah, I can't vouch for Baby Geniuses, but those other recommendations are solid.
Yeah, those are all movies I've had on my list of. At some point, I will watch them. I don't know when.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think you would particularly like The Talented Mr. Ripley.
I thought that was a musical, and I didn't know what it was until maybe last year when I heard a podcast on it. I was like, oh, I guess that's not a musical.
It is not a musical.
It sounds like one. Please have the title.
Like, I will say that Election is one of the best political satires of recent time. And
yeah.
When you look at how Bruce Witherspoon's character is treated, like, there's a reason that that character constantly gets referenced with regards to female politicians today, like Hillary Clinton, and now you could probably apply that meme to Elizabeth Warren.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think it was during the last election, Flip Flops Canada did an episode on Election, in time for Election. But yeah, it's a great episode, listen to Flip Flops Canada. I just have one movie to bring up that came out this year, Best Man, by Malcolm Dealey, who is Spike's cousin, and he directed, he's a Guns for Hire guy, he did Undercover Brother, he did Girls Trip. He just kind of will do, like, whatever, like, the studio needs him to do. But, like, I think that might have been his first movie, Warner's first, but, yeah, Spike's cousin also is also a director with, you know, some success. I'd say more financial success than Spike, but Malcolm is, you know, not the artist that his cousin is. I have other recommends for next episode where I'll go much longer. Joel?
Oh, do I have to pick one?
No, if you want to. Boondock Saints.
I could talk about all the terrible things that came out in 1999.
Or do you want
the best year?
Or do you want to save it for next episode?
You already said Boondock Saints. That came out. Lost and Found with David Spade came out, for God's sake. At First Sight, which is a really weird Val Kilmer is a blind dude movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Baby Geniuses.
Oh, yeah. Yep. The Bachelor with everyone's favorite Chris O'Donnell dude named Chris O'Donnell. Oh, wait. Okay. Something actually good.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I feel like a lot of people didn't like this movie when it came out. Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai. Mm-hmm. Jim Jarmusch, talking about Italian stereotypes. There's a bunch of people doing that, you know, being mobsters in this movie. But it's such a weird movie because it's not... It is about Forrest Whitaker's character, you know, trying to live this samurai code that he's made, like... he has like a book that he's following or something like that, but he's
Joel, it's Rashomon, the story of Rashomon.
He's got the story of Rashomon. That's where he's getting his rules from.
Yeah.
There's multiple stories in there. That doesn't even make any sense.
They talk about like the different, how truth is not just one thing. So it ties into Kurosawa a bit too.
There's something going on underneath this movie that I still haven't really keyed into. Like the scenes where the mobsters are watching the cartoons is weird. There are references to a bunch of other movies that had like assassins in it. Like the scene where Ghost Dog kills a man by removing a pipe from his sink, and when the guy looks up, you know, a red light appears on his head. And shoots him. That's directly ripped off of a French movie that I'm drawing a blank on.
No.
Or is it an Italian movie?
No, it's Japanese. It's the Joe Shishido, Chipmunk Cheeks. Branded to Kill.
Joe Shishido. Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah,
Joe
Shishido. Directly taken from Branded to Kill.
Yeah, it's exactly the same shot.
And watching him interact with people, it's like this kind of weird dream thing going on. But for some reason, I just really dig it. And I'm not sure if it's for everyone. Obviously, based on Spencer's Letterboxd review, which is 2 out of 5 stars.
That's my highest one.
It apparently isn't.
Yeah. I want to like John Mushitz. I don't...
I could spend an hour talking to you about Jim Jarmusch, but we've already gone long enough.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. Like, just if I can have a second, because we mentioned worst films of 1999, I want to point out that Wishmaster 2, Evil Never Dies, came out in 1999. It's a film about an evil genie who, like, grants people's wishes even when they don't intend to wish for something, and there is a scene where a convict tells his lawyer to go fuck himself, and the Wishmaster makes that come true and causes the lawyer to physically fuck himself.
Nice. Yeah, the Wishmaster, like, he grants wishes, but also takes everything literally. So yeah, that's like the gag of the movie, that everything that you wish for, he just gives you like the literal version of it.
Uh-huh, the literal and horrible one.
Yeah, I don't remember which one, because there's like 5 of these fucking things at this point, and there was one.
I think there's 4. Overall.
Is there? Okay, because there's one where like the big climactic scene takes place in a casino, mm-hmm. and like there's like somebody like literally like shitting coins because they wanted to hit the jackpot and stuff like that. It's like, it's like, all right,
amazing.
It's like, all right, movie. No, that'll do. Yeah,
that's Wishmaster 2, with the coin shitting scene and the lawyer fucking.
All right, added to my watch list.
So, Ben, do you have anything? This will come out probably this week. Maybe this weekend. Pretty soon. Within a week or so. So, Ben, do you have anything? Any podcast appearances, articles, reviews, movies? I don't know. I don't know your life.
Yeah, man, I don't have anything. You can check me out on the As If podcast many minutes ago, or on the Rand episode of your Curacao podcast. Otherwise, I'd just recommend calling up those closest to you and telling them that you love them.
Always a good idea. Always a good idea.
Yeah. Like, I mean, what is a phone conversation but a podcast between two people?
Now's not the time for philosophical conversations.
I got one star on iTunes for this. What's going on?
But so, Gina, how have you been since your Midsummer article became a viral sensation?
I've got my mansion. I'm sitting in my. I'm recording this from my rich uncle Scrooge money vault. So I'm doing good. I'm doing great.
Okay. No Kill by Kill updates or anything?
Oh well. Okay. Yeah. No. I do co-host the Kill by Kill podcast, where we talk about horror movies according to the characters. We are currently in the middle of A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master. Our next episode will go up probably a week after recording this. I also am a writer for the pop culture website The Spool, and I have my own website under my name at GinaRadcliffe.com.
Yeah, and I'll put a link to the Midsummer article, and there's some other one I've read recently that I really like. I can't remember which, but I'll link to at least in the Spool shit. But, yeah, thank you guys for coming on.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, and next episode will be Rosetta, the Cannes winner of 99, not the other Oscar movie, the Kevin Spacey one that we didn't want to watch. But I forgot the name. But it's not important. Mm-hmm. American Beauty, that's it. We're skipping that for the Cannes winner instead.
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
Yeah, I'm a little tired of Oscar winners. I want to watch more Cannes winners.
Yeah, that movie has not, I mean, given recent revelations, that movie has not aged very, very well.
That's kind of why we're skipping it. So, yeah. We'll see you guys next time, and thank you.
Bye!
Yeah, bye!
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.